Okay, as we've seen, there were some warnings and chastisements for the people of Judah here, for the people of Judah that are left, because
Microphone
Zephaniah
muted.
Is writing at a time not long before Judah is going to be conquered by the Babylonians, and Israel has already been conquered and mostly deported by the Assyrians, along with those 46 fenced cities of Judah. So we only have the people of Jerusalem that were left in the failed siege of Jerusalem at the time of Hezekiah. And that was in 700 BC or thereabouts. Now it's about between 620 and 612 BC, as best as I could reckon. And we discussed the evidence for that in our last presentation here, in our last discussion on Zephaniah last week. And we have an oracle against Nineveh, which began at the end of chapter 2, perhaps for our purposes here, when Noble begins to read, he might want to start with 2:13, just to put chapter 3 into context. That's what I would suggest. That's his choice. Sorry, Noble, yeah, sure. I put it on you.
Yeah, I can do that.
So it's Nineveh fell in 612 BC. Nineveh was destroyed. That date, none of the chronologies of the ancient world are perfect, but that date is pretty much accurate, at least to within a year or two. Not only Nineveh was destroyed, but all the major cities of the Assyrians were destroyed, and they were destroyed by a consortium of people who had been subject to the Assyrians, and they were mainly the Scythians and Cimmerians, who were really the same people. And they were the people of Israel who were taken into captivity. Isaiah prophesies in Isaiah chapters 10 and 14, he prophesies their involvement in that long before it happened, probably about 90 years before it happened, maybe 100. And also the Persians, Medes, and Babylonians had all joined in a consortium of forces to destroy the Assyrian Empire so that they could have their liberty. That liberty didn't last very long. It only lasted about 7 or 8 years for most of them, because as soon as Nebuchadnezzar II took the throne in Babylon, he set out to reconquer all of the former Assyrian subject kingdoms to himself, which he was pretty successful doing for a while. So the liberty they got by destroying Nineveh and the Assyrians didn't really last very long. But here we are, and it's probably between 620 and 612 BC. And there's a serious oracle about the coming destruction of Nineveh. That's all I have to say.
Zephaniah 2:13. And he will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria, and will make Nineveh a desolation, and dry like a wilderness. And flocks shall lie down in the midst of her. All the beasts of the nations, both the cormorant and the bittern, shall lodge in the upper lintels of it. Their voice shall sing in the windows. Desolation shall be in the thresholds, for he shall uncover the cedar work. This is the rejoicing city that dwelt carelessly, that said in her heart, I am, and there is none beside me. How has she become a desolation, a place for beasts to lie down in? Everyone that passes by her shall hiss and wag his hand. Woe to her that is filthy and polluted, to the oppressing city. She obeyed not the voice, she received not correction, she trusted not in Yahweh, she drew not near to her God. Her princes within her are roaring lions, her judges are evening wolves, they gnaw not the bones till the morrow. Her prophets are light and treacherous persons, her priests have polluted the sanctuary, they have done violence to the law. The just Yahweh is in the midst thereof, he will not do iniquity. Every morning does he bring his judgment to light. He fails not. But the unjust know no shame. I have cut off the nations. Their towers are desolate. I made their streets waste, that none pass by. their cities are destroyed, so there is no man, that there is none inhabitant. I said, surely thou wilt fear me. You will receive instruction, so their dwelling shall not be cut off. Howsoever, I punished them, but they rose early and corrupted all their doings. Therefore wait ye upon me, saith Yahweh, until the day that I rise up to the prey. For my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them my indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. For then will I turn to the people a pure language, that they may all call upon the name of Yahweh to serve him with one consent. From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, my suppliants, even the daughter of my dispersed, shall bring mine offering. In that day shall you not be ashamed for all thy doings, wherein you have transgressed against me. For then I will take away out of the midst of you them that rejoice in your pride, be haughty because of my holy mountain. I will also leave in the midst of you an afflicted and poor people, and they shall trust in the name of Yahweh. The remnant of Israel shall not do iniquity, nor speak lies, neither shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth, for they shall feed and lie down, and none shall make them afraid. Sing, O daughter of Zion, shout, O Israel, be glad and rejoice with all the heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. Yahweh has taken away your judgments. He has cast out your enemy. The King of Israel, even Yahweh, is in the midst of you. You shall not see evil anymore. In that day, it shall be said to Jerusalem, fear you not. And to Zion, let not your hands be slack. Yahweh God in the midst of you is mighty. He will save. He will rejoice over you with joy. Rest in his love. He will joy over you of sinning. I will gather them that are sorrowful for the solemn assembly, who are of thee, to whom the reproach of it was a burden. Behold, at that time I will undo all that afflict you, and I will save her that halts, and gather her that was driven out, and I will get them praise and fame in every land where they have been put to shame. At that time will I bring you again, time that I gather you, for I will make you a name and a praise among all people of the earth, when I turn back your captivity before your eyes, saith Yahweh.
Well, if we want to start at 2:13 or at the beginning and discuss this, that the flock shall lie down in the midst of her, all the beasts of the nations, both the cormorant and the bittern, that of course is just a reference to different classes of people. Assyria being an empire, it's describing Assyria as a whole collection of beasts, right? It's just all the different classes of people. There's similar language elsewhere in the words of the prophets. Where, for he shall uncover the cedar work, that seems to me to refer to the ornate cedar panel decorations of the palaces of the Assyrians and the magnificent institutional buildings of the Assyrians, their treasuries, their libraries, and places like that that would have this ornate cedar work. If you read the Epic of Gilgamesh, it becomes very clear that epic having been set around 2500 BC, that this whole Fertile Crescent thing is bullshit. It's called the Fertile Crescent by anthropologists today in their view of what the ancient world was like. But the ancient world wasn't really like that. It was much more fertile than we know it today, even outside of the Fertile Crescent. And a magnificent cedar forest stretched from Babylon to Lebanon. And that's described, and it becomes evident in the Epic of Gilgamesh. So it's basically not a crescent. It's almost like a straight line, straight west, because Babylon's really east of Jerusalem. It's not really that far north of Jerusalem. Nineveh is a little further north. So it's described as being in the north here, which is fine, but it's really in the northeast. It's really probably almost directly northeast, if my memory serves me well, or maybe east northeast rather than north. So Nineveh is a filthy and oppressing city. And his determination, the determination of Yahweh in verse 8, is to gather the nations that I may assemble the kingdoms to pour upon them my indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. When there's a destruction of a large empire in this manner, that's what happens, is that everybody is going to suffer and be punished, no matter what side of the coin you're on. But whether you're one of the aggressors who are destroying Nineveh, or whether you're one of the Assyrians who are defending it. And all nations would have been affected by it. All the nations of Mesopotamia and thereabouts would have been affected by that. For then will I turn the people to a pure language, that they may call upon the name of Yahweh to serve him with one consent. That's a reference to Israel. Nobody else has an invitation to call upon the name of Yahweh and to serve him. I don't know if there's anything to discuss in those first 9 verses before we get to verse 10, because verse 10 is a highly misunderstood passage.
Well, does a pure language necessarily mean it's going to be a new language? Couldn't it mean something metaphorically too? Like that their heart has been turned to the law of God, so now they're calling in righteousness or something?
Well, yes. I mean, the children of Israel in captivity from this time were basically freed from that captivity to do what they wanted. And although some of them had evidently already migrated away from Assyria, at this time, it's more evident to me in history with the Cimmerians and their crossing of Anatolia, where they looted the cities of the Ionians and the Lydians and destroyed Phrygia at this time, right after the fall of Assyria. The Cimmerians did that. And it seems to me that many more Israelites of the captivity departed Assyria and Mesopotamia at this time and traveled around the Black Sea and into Central Europe, into the Hungarian plain, where that place called Arsareth is, which is where the Cimmerians began to get a foothold into Europe and grow into the Germanic peoples. And that there were other groups that went around the Black Sea that were called Sakae by the Greeks and by the Persians. The Greeks got the name from the Persians. And ultimately, the Greeks began to call them Scythians. And then Galatahi later on. So the Greeks saw two different waves of the same people by two different sets of names, right? Which is probably pretty normal. But no, it really means they're going to speak English. If you ask some of the British Israel people, that pure language is English. It's the purest language. That's what they claim. I've heard them claim that. Yes, I've heard British Israel people make that claim, which is just crazy.
Well, can I add one more thing, Bill? On verse 5, it says, every morning doth he bring his judgment to light. And the thing is, that's probably the prophets, you know, chastising the people. But also when we look at the world around us, we can see his law all around us when we wake up every morning. Like the birds, they all breed with their own kind. They're territorial. They don't make friends with their enemies or anything like that. So the law of God is evident all around us in his creation, is what I wanted to add.
Right.
So every morning his judgment is brought to light.
I would agree with that, yes. And then go up, go and screw it up every evening. Yeah, I would agree with that. That's a fair observation.
It also reminds me of how Yahweh, he described Jeremiah as getting up with the sun every morning. And Jeremiah would get up. It reminds me of how in Jeremiah, he's described as getting up with the sun. Like as soon as the sun rises, he gets up and he starts to reprove the people.
Okay. Or Daniel wakes up every morning in prayers.
Yeah, so it just made me think of the prophets.
Well, verse 9, and I really tried to explain this maybe as best I can in my Genesis podcasts on the Hamites and the Genesis 10 tribes, that those people called the Kassites were almost certainly Cush, and the Cush of the East and the Ethiopians of the East of the Greek writers must have been the Kassites. And I don't, that word Kassite, that A is an interpretation of Aramaic letters, and it could very well be Cusites or Cushites. Even the S, the difference between the S and the SH is an interpretation. I believe those Kassites are Cush, and that where it says the rivers of Ethiopia here is just ridiculous from the perspective of Nineveh and Jerusalem in that perspective, in that context, if we think about Ethiopia in Africa. And there are no rivers of Ethiopia in Africa. There's the Nile River that flows from Ethiopia, but it was always considered the river of Egypt in all of the biblical and ancient literature. This rivers of Ethiopia simply refers to the Euphrates and Tigris rivers, the rivers of Mesopotamia, and that Yahweh is saying that his suppliants would come from beyond the rivers of Mesopotamia, the rivers of Cush. That's all it's saying. And the around the Caspian Sea, and east of the Tigris River, we find many Israelites of the captivity had been settled, who were later called Scythians, in Bactria and Sogdiana and in Hyrcania, which was on the southern shore of the Caspian Sea, and in Parthia, which is between the Tigris River and Hyrcania, on the southwestern shore of the Caspian Sea. So all of these Israelites had come from that area, and they are Yahweh's suppliants. He considered that he called them here his suppliants. And that's historical. To imagine that this Ethiopia is in Africa is just absurd. It's the Cush of Mesopotamia. So those rivers are called the rivers of Cush here. And that's actually settled in Genesis chapter 2, where the one of the rivers of Cush, I believe, were, no, maybe it's Havilah I'm thinking of. No, it's called Ethiopia in the King James Version. Yeah. In Genesis chapter 2, the second river of the garden is the Gihon, and that's identified as the Tigris River. The same is that compasses the whole land of Ethiopia, and that's the Hebrew word Cush. So this rivers of Ethiopia is in Mesopotamia. It's they're not in Africa. And that's, you know, even Bertrand Comparé and Wesley Swift had made the mistake of believing that this Ethiopia was in Africa, which was just absurd. The daughter of my dispersed. Later on in Strabo, and I'm not, my memory's a little faulty, but I'm pretty sure it was Strabo of Cappadocia who described the Massagete, who were a branch of the Scythians, as dwelling in the Oxus and Jaxartes river valleys, which today are known as the Seer Daria and one other Daria. I forget the prefix. Let me see. Amu Daria. The Seer Daria and the Amu Daria mountains were known as the Oxus and Jaxartes rivers. Those Seer Daria and Amu Daria rivers were the Oxus and Jaxartes. Jaxartes, J-A-X-A-R-T-E-S, is a tongue twister for me. Well, those rivers were actually called by those names in the 19th century and until the 20th century in British literature. The Loeb Library is how those rivers are described. They're described with those names in Strabo of Cappadocia in the Loeb Classical Library edition. And Strabo said that the Massagete dwelt in those river valleys, which are almost like just north of India, and they would also be beyond the rivers of Kush from the perspective of Jerusalem. So in all those places, the children of Israel dwelt in their captivity until they migrated, and I'm sure they didn't all migrate, but until sufficient numbers of them began to migrate westward into Europe.
We saw in chapter 2 last week that the immediate context of being released from captivity in Zephaniah was being released from captivity in ancient Babylon so they could come and rebuild the temple. But these final verses here in chapter 3, it must be speaking of our ultimate release from captivity, because we see that Yahshua Christ is king. He's in the midst of us. We will no longer see evil. We're married to him. Would that be fair to say?
Well, it will be fair to say, but I will gather them that are sorrowful for the solemn assembly who are of thee, to whom the reproach of it was a burden. Behold, at that time I will undo all that afflict thee. I will save her that halteth. Now, you could take this language and compare it directly to Micah chapter 4. And let me do that. Let me go get that. I think it's Micah 4:13. No. I know it's right here. Maybe it's Micah 4:7. Yeah, Micah 4:7. Okay. In Micah 4:7, and I will make her, and he's talking about in that day, saith the Lord. And I will make her that halted a remnant, and her that was cast far off a strong nation. And Yahweh shall reign over them in Mount Zion forever. So we could cross-reference Micah chapter 4, verse 7 to this passage in Zephaniah, because it's talking about the same exact thing. It's talking about the dispersed of his people. Behold, at that time will I undo all that afflict thee. In other words, all the nations that oppress. That oppressed Israel would be undone at that time. And that could be true both in a near vision and in a far vision, as you state. And I will save her that halteth, meaning the Israelites that didn't move very far from Mesopotamia or the original places of their captivity, and gather her that was driven out, meaning those who had gone a lot further. I would cross-reference those, heard it was driven out, to Micah chapter 4 in verse 6, and I will gather her that is driven out and her that I have afflicted, and I will make her that halted a remnant and her that was cast far off a strong nation. And I would interpret that to mean that no matter how far the Israelites went away from their original homeland, that Yahweh knows who they are and where they are, and that he will gather them. That's a promise to gather Israel. No matter where they ended up. after the captivities.
We see the far vision in both here and in Micah 4, because Micah, we see a rising thresh. And then here in Zephaniah, we see he has cast out your enemy.
And I will get them to praise and fame in every land where they have been put to shame. And yeah, the children of Israel were put to shame then, but they're being put to greater shame today. For real. I mean, the whole world hates Whitey today.
Yeah.
Or at least if you watch mainstream media, you get that impression that our enemies are doing the best they can to put us to complete shame, to make Christians live in shame. At that time will I bring you again, even in the time that I gather you. And we know that gathering hasn't happened yet. I mean, there was an allegorical gathering in Christ when all of the children of Israel in Europe became Christians. I see that as the near vision gathering. And that's a symbolic gathering because we're all once again worshiping the God of Israel, but it's not a physical gathering. And we're still technically in captivity. We can't live under his laws. We're living under the laws of men, so we must be in captivity.
I love the language here. When I turn back your captivity before your eyes. That's right. That's incredible language.
Right, and we'll see it.
Yeah, hopefully
Yahweh
we live
long enough.
Yeah.
And we're not there yet because we're still captive. We're captive as long as we're not living by God's law. We're captive.
You know what's strange, Bill, is that people are ashamed for things they've done to the Indians and the Jews, like the Holocaust and being mean to Indians and the Abos and stuff, but they're not ashamed for fornication and adultery and stuff like that.
Yeah, you're either ashamed now or you're ashamed then.
Yeah.
Because we're actually living under Jewish morals.
It's like Jesus said, like, those who are ashamed of me, I'll be ashamed of them before my Father. So living in this world, you have to side with Christ, even though you're going to be persecuted for it. And then when you get to the kingdom, you know, you'll be able to have honor with Jesus. Well, you'll feel good that you did the right thing by Jesus, for sure.
When I say we're living under Jewish morals, I'm not saying that the Jews are moral. They're not. We're living under the morals which the Jews have dictated to us that we should be subject to. And those morals have been ingrained into most people today, and even perhaps into some of us or all of us and to one degree or another at some point in our lives. Those morals have been instilled in us through movies, music, and the entire entertainment media, as well as the news media and the educational systems. The Jews have decided what's moral in the West for 150 years now, at least.
In the Wisdom of Solomon, isn't there like a verse where he says, those who have turned their backs on God say that let our strength be the law of righteousness.
Might is right.
Microphone activated.
Right.
It's a Jewish idea.
The other races never feel shame for anything they've done to white people either.
No, and not even to each other. I said long ago that when a nigger looks sullen in court, he doesn't feel bad about what he did. He only feels bad that he got caught. Every single time. When a nigger's upset that he got a court sentence, that he got a prison sentence, he's never upset about what he did. He's only upset about getting caught and being punished for it.
They can't blush.
You know, I've heard white people say, well, in Islam, they're allowed to because, you know, people are considered infidels that aren't Islamic. But that's bullshit, too, because all the secular non-white people do the same thing. They have no religion at all. And like you said, they feel no shame.
Yeah, they feel no shame about their own sin, like fornication and adultery. They don't.
Yeah, and it's not based on some sort of religious text that they believe in. It's just their nature.
I really love verse 17. Yahweh, your God, in the midst of you is mighty. He will save. And that makes me think of the second advent. But what I really love about this verse is the next part. He will rejoice over you with joy. He will rest in his love. And I hope the grammar of this verse is correct, because we have so many prophecies speaking about our rest. But here, if the grammar is correct, it's saying that he will rest in his love. And it makes me think of how Paul wrote in Hebrews that a time of rest remains for the people of Yahweh, because the first Joshua didn't give them rest. And the rest of the first Joshua was connected with exterminating the Canaanites. And because they failed to exterminate them, they did not receive that rest. And then here, the second Joshua, he's in the midst of you. He is mighty. He will save. And he does that through his vengeance. And because he achieves that, and he achieves that threshing, he rests now. We achieve that rest of Joshua now. But not only us, but him also, because he's tabernacling with us as a kinsman, as brethren. And because he's becoming brethren to us, he's also partaking in that same rest which awaits the people of Yahweh. It also makes me think of how Christ said that everything you've done to the least one of these, you've done to me. So God is suffering along with his people.
I like what you say, but I do think Yahweh is in rest at the moment.
Well, that's why I'm thinking it's Christ, right? Because, you know, it's specifically Christ coming, and because he's becoming a kinsman to us, he's also sharing in the rest of his people. But yeah, he's currently in his rest. Paul said that in Hebrews 2, I think. But I'm thinking of Yahshua Christ, Yahweh as Yahshua specifically.
Yeah, you still hear me?
See, I think that the grammar depends upon the vowel points. I mean, there are differences in grammar in certain passages. But you and he, the same word without the vowel points has been translated, you shall hold your peace and he shall hold his peace. The same word, right?
Right.
It seems, I would have to see if it's used in a singular context in every single one of these occurrences, which would take a little time and probably take more time than we have here.
Well, regardless,
in Isaiah chapter, I'm sorry, in Isaiah chapter 42, it's I have long time held my peace, right? And that's the same form, but different vowel points, right? That these Jews may have changed the meanings of entire passages with their interpretation of what the vowel point should be, right? I cannot be silent is the same form in Jeremiah 4:19, right? I cannot hold my peace in the King James Version. So I would really have to study this. And that's because in the Septuagint translation, and this holds true in the Greek, Yahweh thy God is in thee, the mighty one shall save thee. He shall bring thee joy and shall refresh thee with his love. You see what I mean?
Refresh, right? Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
The word, according to Brown Driver Briggs, can mean to be silent, dumb, or speechless, to be deaf, to make deaf, to restrain, to be silent, of God's keeping silence when men pray, to be deaf again, to exhibit silence or be silent. they have Zephaniah 3:17 cited and say that he will renew his love rather than refresh them with his love, right? He will renew his love. Keep silence. It would, to get us down to that level of granularity, I would rather wait to do an entire word study where this form of these letters appears to see all the grammatical possibilities without the damn vowel points, right? Because the Septuagint translators read something different. They read the word, the same word in the same, probably the same form, not definitely. I would have to compare it to the Dead Sea Scrolls, but they translated it a little differently. He will refresh you with his love. So I see what you're saying about the passage, and that's fine and well and good and true, but it may not be saying that, as you admitted. So
yeah, I was keeping cautious
about actually coming to a decision. If I was writing this commentary and if I thought that was an issue, right? The things that I include in my commentaries are the things that I think need explanation or that might be issues. So a lot of times in the commentary, I'll just blow past a line like this, right? Because there's no apparent issue with it. So, and take it at face value. If I was doing a commentary and understood it was an issue with this particular word, I actually, every commentary I write, I sit down in the Hebrew and I look at every occurrence of that particular form. And there might be hundreds of occurrences, so maybe I'll just look at enough of them to understand what the possibilities are for translating that word. Because sometimes the grammar is dictated by letters before and after the word, prefixes and suffixes and things like that. And I mentioned a lot of them in my Genesis series, a lot of those prefixes and suffixes on Hebrew words. But sometimes it's only determined by these vowel points. I would rather determine the grammar by context rather than by vowel points, which is all the rabbis did anyway, but I don't trust their judgment.
I really do find it a beautiful thing that in the past we were released out of captivity in Egypt, and then after a time of waiting, we were led by a man named Joshua to exterminate the Canaanites and achieve rest. And we didn't get that rest, but it's a beautiful thing how we're expecting it again from the second Joshua, and it just rhymes.
Right.
So beautifully. It just rhymes so beautifully.
The first pattern, and it's in the Revelation, right? Sodom and Egypt, that we're going to be delivered out of Sodom and Egypt once again. It's the pattern. It proves that Yahweh God is the author of Scripture.
Yeah, it's so profound, right? Like, both times we're led by a man named Joshua. User
disconnected. Right. It's so profound. Only Yahweh saves us.
Yeah. Incredible.
You see in verse 11, Bill, it says, because of my holy mountain. But whenever I see the term holy mountain, I try and imagine it meaning the nation of Israel. So this verse doesn't make sense to me, because it says, and thou shalt no more be haughty because of my holy mountain. And it's like, they are his holy mountain. So is this trying to refer to the temple or something?
No, because he's talking about Nineveh. This is an oracle against Nineveh, that they will no longer be haughty. On account of my holy mountain.
On account of Israel. All right.
Yeah. I will also leave in the midst of thee an afflicted and poor people, and they shall trust in the name of Yahweh. And that's a remnant of Israel that would be left among the Assyrians. And that's true. Is historical verification of that. That Scythians had remained in Mesopotamia even after the destruction of the cities of Assyria.
That's a CI verse right there.
Yeah, I mean, every other verse in the prophets is probably a CI verse in one way or another. Maybe every fourth verse.
Every verse in the Bible is a CI verse, even the begot verses, which the Judeos think are really boring, because we can use those and we can be like, hey, look, genealogy does matter. So literally every verse.
Absolutely. There's so many places in the prophets that genealogy matters. I don't know how the hell that the level of self-righteousness and audacity that men have to get to the New Testament and say, oh, genealogy don't matter, only for Jesus. They really only believe that he's the seed and genealogy only matters for him.
Yeah, but then they say he's mixed race, which disgusts me. Oh, he was a Moabite. He was part Moabite. And when they say that, I just think that's blasphemy.
Yeah, when they make that blasphemy, it makes me think of two verses. It makes me think of Isaiah 53, where it says, and who shall declare his race? And then it makes me think of how Zerubbabel was a type for Christ, and it means sown in confusion. So like everyone's confused and they don't really understand that Christ was white.
Yeah, and it makes God look like he has that law, no Moabite shall enter the congregation of the Lord. And then, like, a little bit later, he changes his mind. Yeah, no, let the Moabites in. And you know what? I'll even make David king. A Moabite can be king now. So, you know, just forget the law. You know, just whatever.
They basically act like Yahweh gives the law because it's, like, fun or cool, but it's not, like, a concrete moral objective truth, so he can sort of just give it and take it as he sees fit.
That's how they treat the law, though. They feel like, oh, you know, yeah, there's a law there, but my feelings, you know, I feel that it wasn't that bad, so I just did it anyways. You know, I'm sure God will understand, because he's a feeling-based guy like me. You know, he'll understand.
It's gross.
It is gross, yeah. Well, I guess we're going on the prophet Haggai, Bill. I could hear your mouse. your mic activated when you used the scroll on your mouse.
Sorry. I should cut off the click, but when I do, then it scrolls way past where I always wanted to end up. Yeah, I was kind of getting a little introduction to Haggai together in my head. I guess we could do that. It's only 9:10. Hey guys, only two chapters by about 30, 40 verses, maybe at the most, not even. Hey guy, here we're going to jump ahead, and we're going to jump ahead almost 180 years almost to the Persian period. Hey guy. The jump wouldn't be as great if the minor prophets were in the correct order, but they're not. Haggai is a prophet of the rebuilding of the temple, of the second temple. He's a contemporary with Zechariah. If you read the prologue to the 147th Psalm, in the Septuagint, that Psalm is credited with having been written by Haggai and Zechariah. By the two prophets. They were both together with Zerubbabel when he returned to Jerusalem sometime around 520 BC, maybe a year later, and in the year following, I should say. All these chronologies can be off by 1, 2, 3 years, some of them. I won't elaborate on that, but it's evident in many places in ancient history. So we do the best we can with the scant records that were given. They didn't keep years like we did, so it's kind of difficult in places. But this is about 521 BC was about when Darius, the king who finally approved that Zerubbabel return and rebuild the temple, he took office about 521 BC. And in his second year, it would be about 520 BC. When they say in the second year, that could be his 13th month, his 12th month and a day, right? When the day after your first anniversary as king is your the beginning of your second year as king. So this is 520, or perhaps this plays out in 519 BC, the way we reckon the years, doesn't really matter that much. And Haggai is a contemporary of Zerubbabel and Zechariah, who has a much longer prophecy. Haggai is relatively short. And they're both with Zerubbabel as he returns to Jerusalem to build the second temple. So we see Zerubbabel here. And this is basically an admonishment of the children of Israel and to keep them remembering what had happened to them before what is about to happen to them, before what they're about to be able to accomplish in the rebuilding of the temple. So he's still admonishing the people of Judah who are about to return to Jerusalem, or who are about to begin the project of the building the second temple. Let me put it that way. That's all I have to say as an introduction to Haggai. So we can reckon the year is 520 BC.
The Book of Haggai, Chapter 1. In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of Yahweh by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua the son of Jozadak, the high priest, saying, Thus speaketh Yahweh of hosts, saying, This people say, Time is not come, the time that Yahweh's house should be built. Then came the word of Yahweh by Haggai the prophet, saying, Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste? Now therefore, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, Consider your ways. You have sown much and bring in little. You eat, but you have not enough. You drink, but you are not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earns wages to put it into a bag with holes. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, Consider your ways. Go up to the mountain and bring wood and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith Yahweh. Ye looked for much, and lo, it came to little. And when you brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why, saith Yahweh of hosts, as of mine house that is waste, and you run every man unto his own house. Therefore the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from her fruit. And I called for a drought upon the land, and upon the mountains, and upon the corn, and upon the new wine, and upon the oil, and upon that which the ground brings forth, and upon men, and upon cattle, and upon all the labor of the hands. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of Yahweh their God, the words of Haggai the prophet, as Yahweh their God had sent him. And the people did fear before Yahweh. Then spoke Haggai, Yahweh's messenger, and Yahweh's message unto the people, saying, I am with you, saith Yahweh. And Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people. And they came and did work in the house of Yahweh of hosts, their God, in the 24th day of the 6th month, in the 2nd year of Darius, their king. Darius, the king. End of Haggai chapter 1.
Okay. There's probably a little more historic background that I could add to this, that I should add to this. And this is probably a good place to do it. Cyrus the Great was king of Persia from 550 to 529 BC. Some sources have his death being 530 BC. The difference is immaterial of 1 year. So he had first issued a proclamation that the people of Judah and people of other kingdoms also could, after the destruction of Assyria and the overthrowing of Babylon, after he conquered Babylon in 539 BC, he made this proclamation that the people of Judah could return to Jerusalem and rebuild their temple. Even Herodotus, both Herodotus and Daniel mention that under Persian law, the laws of a king, the decrees of a king had to stand. They could not be changed by future kings. So Cyrus made this declaration and the subsequent kings had to obey it. So Cyrus didn't put a year on the rebuilding of the temple or make any constraint, but he allowed the people to return to Jerusalem. So where we read in this first chapter of Haggai, why are you in sealed houses and this house lie waste? Those people had already returned to Jerusalem, but the temple wasn't built yet. And the 70 years of Jeremiah's prophecy desolation wasn't over yet. But evidently, at least the people of Zerubbabel came back to Jerusalem and began to inhabit it sometime after Cyrus made that decree.
User entered your channel.
I don't know the exact year the decree was made, but it had to be made before 530 BC. And now we're in Darius in 521 BC. So Cyrus died. He was killed evidently in a battle with the Scythians by the Araxes River in Media in the north in 530. And Cambyses, his son, becomes king. And Cambyses was a very harsh man. He was remembered by the histories as being a very harsh man. And he only ruled 7 years. And he was being petitioned by the Samaritans and the Edomites against the people of Judah in Jerusalem, who were trying to encourage him not to let them rebuild the temple. And Cambyses ordered the halting of the rebuilding of the temple. From what I understand, if I remember Josephus correctly, they did work on the foundations and had the foundations complete, but didn't rebuild the temple, and they were halted by Cambyses. They couldn't work on it any further. So that's sometime between 529 and 522 BC. Cambyses went on a military campaign to recover Egypt and Ethiopia in Africa for the Persians that were previously under the rule of Babylon. And he was badly injured in that campaign. And I believe, if Herodotus is correct, he died on the way home. And supposedly, this is the Greek version of events. There's a different Persian version that differs somewhat, but I only know the Greek version, so I'll repeat that here. A Magi named Smerdis, the Greeks called him Smerdis. That's not really his name. He has a different name in the Persian version, but the Greeks called Persians whatever, or Babylonians or Assyrians or Egyptians, whatever the hell they wanted to. This Smerdis, the Magi, or this particular Magi, it was Cambyses' brother who was named Smerdis. This particular Magi pretended, killed Cambyses' brother and pretended to be his brother, according to the Greek version of events in Herodotus. So the Greeks knew him as pseudo-Smerdis, the fake Smerdis. And he only ruled Persia for 9 months, never left the palace, kept himself concealed, ruled for 9 months, and supposedly a consortium of seven of the noble families of Persia, including Darius Hystaspes, got together and realized that this guy was a usurper, and they raided the palace and killed him, and they took over Persia. They took over the throne of Persia, ended the line of Cyrus, and Darius was appointed as the new king out of those seven men, the seven men who were of the principal families of the Persians. That's Herodotus's version of events. It's probably the best version I can recount. I know elements of the Persian version of events, but I can't really put it all together. But in the end, the result is the same. This Smerdis only ruled for 9 months, and Darius became the king. So when Darius became the king, he had permitted the temple to be built, which was halted in the time of Cambyses, in spite of the objections of the Edomites and the Samaritans. That's the story there. And that's why here it seems that people are dwelling around Jerusalem, but they're not rebuilding the temple. It's because, and Josephus explains it in detail, and it's I trust the account Josephus gives, except for a couple of minor mistakes that I saw he made because he was confused. But it's more or less trustworthy. That's the account that I think is the best account. That Cambyses halted, even though some of them returned to Jerusalem, perhaps 40,000 of them, as we find in Ezra in chapter 1. Ezra is writing in 458 BC, and his first 5.5 or 6.5 chapters, I forget which, it's outlined in my notes at Christogenia, what we're actually recounting things that happened during the time of Zerubbabel. So that 42,000 or whatever it was in Ezra returned in between the time of Cyrus and Darius, but they couldn't rebuild the temple. And now here, they are going to be told by Yahweh to rebuild the temple. Well, of course, it would be the responsibility of Yahweh to make it right with the Persians, right? He would have to put it in the heart of Darius, and evidently he does.
Well, Christ is the true temple. And in the prophet Zechariah, we see all the opposition to the rebuilding of the temple also. So there's always this opposition to Christ, and there's always the opposition to the building of the true temple of God. And then you have the unfaithful among us who aren't building the temple, you know, his temple. So I always
absolutely. And when we read Zechariah, the parallels between Zechariah and the crucifixion of Christ, the ministry and crucifixion of Christ are great. They really are.
And the Jews are still trying to do it today, Bill. It's all these Edomites trying to prevent us from building up the true temple of God in Christ.
Right. And they get away with it because the pastors don't really teach the Bible correctly. If they taught the Bible correctly and things like that, the parallels between what happened in Zechariah's day and what happened in the ministry of Christ, then the nature of the Jew would stand out as Satan, and we wouldn't have half the problems we have today. But they don't teach the Bible properly because they learned it from Jews.
A lot of these Judeos think they're still waiting to help the Jews build the third temple.
Wow. I mean, if you're a Christian, why would you do that? Like, why would you do that when, like, the New Testament makes it so clear that Christ is a temple? Do they really want to do that?
That's the whole objective of Freemasonry. That's the entire objective. Freemasonry is completely Jewish in its objectives. The whole objective of Freemasonry is to build the third temple, which is really the fourth temple, but they're too stupid to know that. is to build the third temple and seat a Jew there to run to rule the world.
I've heard Judeo-Christians say, "Oh, isn't it sad? How are the Jews going to rebuild the temple? Because the Muslims have a thing there now." And it's like,
I don't know much about Judeos, but when I hear about the stuff they believe in and the stuff they say, like here, I didn't know that. Wow, dummies.
Yeah, I'm waiting for they think there's going to be a time when the Jews are rebuilding the temple and they're all like excited about it or whatever.
Noble, that's why Zionism, in the Judeo-Christian mind, that's why Zionism is so important to them. That's why Israel, the land of Israel, is so important to them, because Christ won't come until that happens in their mind.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't totally understand that worldview, but I've heard them say stuff like that, and that was my sort of understanding.
Yeah, I just thought they were happy that the Jews went back, because that's how they interpret several prophecies in the Old Testament. So they're like, yay.
No, it's a lot deeper than that. The subterfuge and the deception is a lot deeper than that. The Judeo-Christians really believe that if they help Israel and they help Jews, that more Jews will go back to Palestine. And when they build that temple, that Jesus will come, because he's going to stand in his temple. Wow.
They should read Malachi 1, where it's like Edom's building up the ruined places, and they should be like, what? These Jews, they're Edomites? I've been helping Edomites?
They'll never put that together, no matter how many times they read Malachi, because it doesn't fit into their paradigm, so it must mean something else.
Anyways, I think it's really funny that they called that guy Pseudo Smyrna. Was it Smyrna, Bill?
Pseudo Smyrtus.
Smyrtus. They called him Pseudo Smyrtus because they knew he was the fake Smyrtus.
Yes.
Now, is it true that Darius, is it really the man's name, or is it just a title?
It's a title. I believe Cyrus is a title too. Darius is a title.
Right, so there could have been multiple Darius.
There were actually multiple men named Darius, and sometimes Cyrus is referred to as Darius.
Okay.
Because it's a title.
Right, not that it really changes anything that it's saying. It's just that it could be easy for people that aren't educated to make mistakes when studying history.
Well, it's very difficult to put to piece together this history. I did the best I can right there at that length. I mean, I may have improved on that in some of my podcasts where I discuss this general outline in several other ways. But I don't remember. I don't remember if I improved on it or not. I think I would have edited this if it was anything major. But I pieced this together because I was having a, I don't want to call it a dispute, maybe a conversation with Clifton. Probably 22, 23 years ago, a long time ago, I pieced this together for Clifton and sent it to him. While I was in prison. There was a point where he had actually got into the 70 weeks prophecy in his teaching letters.
You know, this verse 6, it says, ye have sown much and bring in little, ye eat, but ye have not enough, ye drink, but are not filled.
Here it is. It's not as long ago as I thought. It's 2009. So I was already home from prison, but I wasn't home but for about 6 months when this was published in May. So that's when, well, I think I had the notes all together when I was in prison. I'm actually pretty sure. So that was an early version of the first link, right? I've improved on it since I did it in 2009.
Who else did you say had the title Darius Spill?
In fact, if you scroll down on that page from Emma Heiser, I wrote Clifton that November 3rd, 2002. I wrote that to him. And at the bottom, Clifton says, "Thank you, William Fink, for sharing the notes you put together 7 years ago." So I sent it to him in 2002, but he didn't use it until 2009. I think that's funny, but that's the way it is, right? I'm sorry, Joe.
Who did you say also had the title Darius? I'm looking at your paper now.
I believe that, I don't know if it's in this paper, but I'm pretty sure that Cyrus is called Darius somewhere.
Microphone activated.
Called Darius the Mede by Daniel.
Yeah, it could be that. And that's certainly a reference to Cyrus in Daniel chapter 11.
We actually discussed that on Bible study when we did that. You mentioned it.
Okay. And First Esdras is so much better a version of Ezra than Ezra is. It really is in several respects.
Yeah, like the Masoretic Ezra is basically abridged. It's like the abridged version.
Yes, with some crucial passages missing. Like the passage about the Edomites tearing down the temple. Tearing down the I don't remember exactly how it reads. It's in First Ezra's chapter 4. I've cited it before in podcasts, though. Along with one of the Psalms.
137.
Well, here at verse 6.
First Ezra, chapter 4, verse 45. Thou hast also vowed to build up the temple which the Edomites burned when Judea was made desolate by the Chaldees. And that's the portion of Ezra that is actually referring back to the time of Zerubbabel. I'm sorry, Joe.
No, it's all right. I wasn't sure how. at verse 6, it says, "Ye have sown much and bring in little," right? Well, in Hosea, it says, "Ye shall commit whoredom and not increase." So it's always every time they're doing these sins, it doesn't matter what they do, they just never have enough. They can even commit whoredom and they're not increasing. And that reminds me of today, where all our people are committing whoredom and the birth rate is just dropping. And it's like they're more adulterous than ever, but our people are shrinking.
Yep.
And we've got all these aliens among us who just, like, how these niggas just devour and devour and devour, and same with all the rest of them. So we just don't increase because these non-whites live among us like locusts and like cankerworms, and they just gobble up everything they can.
Yeah, but the opposite of that, the exact opposite of that is when the people were oppressed in Egypt and had nothing and were enslaved, yet they were very fruitful.
Okay. You know, I didn't think of that, but they didn't know Yahweh at that time either, so
they did know Yahweh to a degree. I mean, they had the accounts of God handed down from Jacob and the patriarchs, but that they weren't. But when you're oppressed in a state of slavery and you're poor, you're not partying it up and being a pervert, I gather.
Well, they did go into captivity many times for their own good.
Yes. As like Clifton used to say about the Roaring Twenties, during the 20s when everybody was having a great time and there was lots of money, the skirts went up and up and up. And as soon as the Depression hit, the skirts went back down and down and down.
Yeah, that's longer. Funny.
And the party was over.
Women stopped cutting their hair so short like they did in the 20s.
Yes. Yeah, that's another big thing about the 20s. I saw a picture of my father's mother from the 20s, and her hair was dyed black, and it was really short, like almost up to her ears. And it was, I'm like, what the fuck, Grandma? You were trying to emulate the flappers.
Oh, that you sold it to them. They also told them to smoke and drink in bars, and they did.
Yep. But it wasn't like that in the 60s. I did that in a podcast a couple of weeks ago.
Bill, I remember I remember that when women couldn't go in the bar. That was in my time.
Yeah. See, that I got corroboration from somebody almost as old as me, I think.
Yeah, it took a while to get back to the 20s.
Yeah, it did. It happened again in the 80s. Women were going in bars freely. Late 70s, probably. After that women's lib thing in the early to mid 70s. But even then, with that, even in the early 90s, I remember there were some bars in New Jersey that were very reluctant and discouraged having women there. Bartenders do not like to see women in bars because all it causes is drama and trouble. And it's not necessarily the woman's fault. It's the men that are all trying to jockey for position. It's crazy. I mean, sometimes it is the woman's fault when she's wearing half her clothes.
It takes two to tango. They're both
bad. Yeah, but as soon as men see women in a bar, they're going to be lecturing around. Even if she's not available, they're going to be leering in the wings.
Step two.
This guy.
Well, we kind of had a stall tactic going on, Martin. I guess we could do chapter two. Halfway, half at a time, maybe.
Haggai chapter two. In the seventh month, in the 1 20th day of the month, came the word of Yahweh by the prophet Haggai, saying, "Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and to the residue of the people, saying, Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? Yet now be strong, saith Yahweh, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Jozadak, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, saith Yahweh, and work, for I am with you, saith Yahweh of hosts. according to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, so my spirit remains among you. Fear ye not. For thus saith Yahweh of hosts, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will make all nations, desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith Yahweh of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith Yahweh of hosts. The glory of this latter house shall be greater than of the former, saith Yahweh of hosts. And in this place will I give peace, saith. In the four and do you want me to stop here, Bill? Or do you want me to continue?
Where are we? I mean, do we have anything to discuss here? Probably.
I don't know. Okay. Yeah.
I'd like to give some background on Zerubbabel real quick. Zerubbabel was, of course, the heir to the king, the heir to the throne. He's in both of the genealogies of Christ, in spite of the differences between those genealogies before and after Zerubbabel. And I attribute that to levirate marriages, but that's beside the point. Zerubbabel's in both of them. He's without doubt a physical ancestor of Christ. Well, a physical ancestor of Joseph of Nazareth, so that Christ would inherit the throne Zerubbabel was entitled to, but he never sat on. But he must have been appointed the governor of Judea in the return of the Judeans to Jerusalem. He must have been appointed by the king to be the de facto leader of those people and govern Jerusalem on his behalf. And Nehemiah also had the commission, and so did Ezra. Nehemiah had it from 503 BC to 490 BC, and Ezra had it from 458 BC. For however many years he lasted, I really don't remember. Or maybe I can't know, because we're not told. We're not told when Ezra died, right? So Zerubbabel actually means sown in Babylon. Zerub meaning to sow, and Babel meaning Babel or Babylon. Which is another evidence that the children of Israel really did call Babylon Babel, as it is called in Genesis chapter 10. So he's reassuring them on the basis of his covenant with them since the time he brought them out of Egypt, that they're still his people. The desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory. The desire of all nations are the riches and the treasures that all nations covet, as far as I'm concerned, that they will come to this temple that's going to be rebuilt. Which is why it mentions the silver and the gold in verse 8. And I really believe that that's also a vision for a far vision as well as a near vision, right? The glory of this later house shall be greater than that of the former. And that wasn't, I don't believe that's basically speaking about the construction of the temple itself. The temple that Zerubbabel built only took 5 years to build. It really wasn't that magnificent. It couldn't have been in 5 years. It took Solomon much longer to build the first temple, and Herod much, much longer to build the third temple. But I think it's speaking more to the purpose of the temple rather than to its material form. That's my opinion.
I think the second clause of that verse makes it clear where he says, I will give peace here. And that's why it's greater.
Yes, that's agreeable. Okay, we could finish the second half of this chapter, I believe.
Haggai 2:10. In the 24th day of the 9th month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of Yahweh by Haggai the prophet, saying, saith Yahweh of hosts, ask now the priests concerning the law, saying, if one bears holy flesh in the skirt of his garment, and with his skirt do touch bread or pottage or wine or oil or any meat, shall it be holy? And the priest answered and said, no. Then said Haggai, if one that is unclean by a dead body touch any of these, shall it be unclean? And the priest answered and said, it shall be unclean. Then answered Haggai and said, so is this people, and so is this nation before me, saith Yahweh, and so is every work of their hands, and that which they offer there is unclean. And now I pray you, consider from this day and upward, from before a stone was laid upon a stone in the temple of Yahweh, those days were, when one came to an heap of 20 measures, there were but 10. When one came to the press vat, for to draw out 50 vessels out of the press, there were but 20. I smote you with blasting and with mildew and with hail and all the labors of your hands. Yet you turned not to me, saith Yahweh. Consider now from this day and upward, the 24th day of the 9th month, even from the day that the foundation of Yahweh's temple was laid. Consider it. Is the seed yet in the barn? Yea, as yet the vine and the fig tree and the pomegranate and the olive tree has not brought forth, from this day will I bless you. And again the word of Yahweh came unto Haggai in the 24th day of the month, saying, speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth, and I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms, and I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen, and I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them, and the horses and their riders shall come down, every one by the sword of his brother. In that day, saith Yahweh of hosts, I take you, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, saith Yahweh, and will make thee as a signet, for I have chosen thee, saith Yahweh of hosts. End of the book of Haggai.
Well, it's just a reminder of their punishments and the reasons why they should do well, right? The reasons why they should seek to do good and be obedient.
Zerubbabel's likely wondering, you know, like, why is Yahweh saying this to me? Well, you're a type, my friend.
Right.
You're a type. Right. Oh, wait, it's not me?
Well, I will overthrow the thrones of kingdoms and will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen. I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them and all of this in that day. And yeah, you're a type, but it's also a very clear type. I would cross-reference that to, I think it's in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, where Paul tells the Corinthians that they'll be able to punish all disobedience once their obedience is fulfilled.
Well, Paul actually quotes this very verse from Haggai somewhere, I think in Hebrews. I will shake the heavens and the earth. He quotes that.
Yes, he does. That's correct. I could go looking for that passage. Just to see the context in which he quotes it.
Somewhere in Hebrews.
You have to say, look up, shake heaven. It's heavens in Haggai. It's heaven in Paul. And that's the wonderful consistency. Nah, but it's singular in Paul's Greek. I can see that.
Well, when Paul was writing his epistle to the Hebrews, he didn't have his scrolls.
City refused not him that speaks, for if they escaped not who refused him that spoke on earth, much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him that speaks from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth, but now he has promised, saying, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but the heaven also. That's wow. Isaiah. Maybe.
Oh, so he's not quoting Haggai. Or I guess it's seen in both prophecies.
I mean the concept that Yahweh God will do this on behalf of the children of Israel, right? That therefore I will shake the heavens and the earth shall remove out of her place in the wrath of Yahweh of hosts in the day of his fierce anger, Isaiah 13:13. So I mean that can also be cross-referenced here. It's fine that should be cross-referenced here. But here it's more like a promise that he's going to shake the heavens and the earth. And that's going to be a good thing for Zerubbabel. As long as the children of Judah are doing the things they're supposed to be doing, that's going to be to their benefit, not to their hurt. So we wait for that today for our benefit. As long as we're his people and we're striving to do well, it's going to be for our benefit, not for our hurt. When we see Babylon fall,
our captivity is released in front of our very eyes.
Right. And I'm not saying there's not going to be any hardship. Of course, there are going to be temporary setbacks and hardships.
Like at your woman.
Like so if our Xbox time. Doesn't work anymore, I mean, most people would think that's absolute hell. If they can't get the ball game on Starlink, they're just fucked.
We're a very soft generation.
Yeah. Today, people are incredibly soft.
Most men are. Their whole identity is based around not offending people and being nice.
Right.
Seeking validation. That's a thing.
That's why niggers chimp out when they're not validated.
Yeah.
And that's why all the sodomites, that's why they need you to accept them so that they have validation, so that their sin is validated. They're not comfortable in their sin. It proves it. They're not comfortable in their sin as long as their sin is recognized as sin.
Some people think the niggers are masculine, Bill, but I don't think they are. I think they're effeminate and attention-seeking, and they've got no courage, they've got no values or strength. They're not masculine
right,
at
they're
all.
They're absolutely only feminine, I agree. All their qualities are feminine. They might be, some of them might be strong or athletic, but all their qualities are feminine. Because they react solely on emotion rather than on logic.
It's the same with the Jews and the rest of them. They're all the same.
And they go ballistic at the what they think is the most minor slight drives them crazy. They go ballistic. They can't handle it. They can't handle any adversity.
That's why the Jews chose them to use.
Yeah.
We were talking about the meaning of the name Zerubbabel, and I just Googled the meaning of the name Shealtiel, his father. And according to Google, at least, the name means I asked God for this child. And I think that's quite beautiful, considering that Zerubbabel is a type for Christ, because basically all of Israel asked God for a Messiah. And we're expectant and praying for that.
Yeah, that's a good observation, Noble. It according to this, it means I have asked of God. So, I mean, the for this child part is inferred or maybe perhaps even implied in the name. But it means I have asked of God. So on that level of the esoteric meanings of Hebrew names, I agree with you, yes. I want to see what the original Strong's Concordance says. which requires my actually thumbing through this book. I'm sure I'll be married to it for the next 2 days as I type my podcast, though.
You know, Bill, it hadn't been that long ago when they started letting the nigger be educated. Used to, they wouldn't educate them because they knew they'd take it and use it against us.
Right.
Well, what's the point? It's like trying to educate abos and all the teachers complain. And it's like, yeah, well, stop complaining. They're fucking abos. Get real.
Yeah, it's a damn waste, you know?
Absolutely. And they do just rend us with it. It's a pearl that they turn and rend us with. There's no doubt. You have a nigga read the Bible, and all of a sudden he's a black Hebrew Israelite. Because he read that Solomon said he was black. They can't read anything below the surface of the words. They don't understand allegory or analogy.
It seems to me, you know, all non-white intellectualism is just complaining about racism. Like, they'll put on glasses and a suit, and they'll pretend they're an intellectual, and all that comes out of their mouth is, "Whitey is racist."
Yes, Noble, even in Strong's original concordance, which is, it's rare that it agrees with this Bible work, Strong's data, it means I have asked of God. Shealtiel. Which I could kind of see the components there. Because Sheol is a request. And I really believe that's the root of the English word shall, which is a which expresses a request. Yes.
Right.
I think I actually have that in my English from Hebrew list. Which has many critics, but I don't give a fuck. They could all die. Dumb motherfuckers.
Well, there's part where the priests ask about the unclean and the clean. They asked about the law. That reminds me of Ezekiel 22, which I just looked up. They have made no distinction between the holy and the profane. They have not taught the people the difference between the unclean and the clean. And they hide their eyes from my Sabbaths, and I am profaned among them. So the priests at that time were failing to distinguish between clean and unclean. And today we've got these priests who invite non-whites into their congregations and fail to distinguish between the clean and the unclean. And the profane, right, which is sinning, you know, when Israel sins, they become profane. So they haven't taught their congregation, don't commit adultery, you know, don't, you know, brag about eating pork, etc.
In verse 23, Zerubbabel's called a signet, and in the Septuagint, it has seal. And that makes me think of Daniel chapter 9, where one of the purposes of the Messiah, whom Zerubbabel's a type for here, is to seal up the vision and prophecy, which, as I understand, basically means to fulfill. And Christ said he came to fulfill the law and the prophets.
Well, if you think of that word signet and what it means, it actually means a seal. Yeah, and we have a signature. Ring. We have a signature. In the ancient world, you put a seal on a document, that was your signature. You were signing onto that it was true. You were taking responsibility for the words of that document when you sealed it, that it was authentic and true. And that's what a signet is here in this case, that Yahweh is proving that his word is authentic and true by having Zerubbabel build that second temple.
So his prophecy is going to come true, because that second temple is definitely going to be built. And when you see it, that's a seal from Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
Not only prophecies in Daniel, but the most important prophecy in play right here is Jeremiah's 70 years prophecy, that Jerusalem would be desolate 70 years. And by my chronology, it took Zerubbabel 5 years to rebuild the temple, And those 5 years were most likely from when they began the project, when they had the permission to begin the project in this ninth month of the second year of Darius, which is roughly equates to 520 BC to 516 BC, by which time the second temple was rebuilt. And that's why it couldn't have been a very elaborate temple, because it only took 5 years to build. And those 5 years are, it says 5 years to build explicitly in somewhere in the writings. Don't ask me where, I don't remember where, but it's there. I'll try to find it real quick if I can. Ezra chapter 7, verse 8. No, that's out of context. That's speaking about a later time. Damn it. Zechariah chapter 8 speaks about the temple being built, but that doesn't give me the time frame. I have it from somewhere. I got to look back and see where I got it from. Nope, I ain't gonna find it right now. I have in Revelation part 28. Let's see if I have a citation for it. Nope. It had taken 2 years to prepare the foundations, and then Zerubbabel was stalled by politics and opposition from neighboring tribes for many years. When building was finally resumed in 520 BC, the temple was completed by 516 BC. And the short amount of time and the scant resources indicate that this temple was much less magnificent than those of either Solomon or Herod, which is true, but I don't know why I didn't actually cite where I got that information from. I apologize, but it's got to be from somewhere that's right in front of my face that I can't find it. Here it is. I got it now, I think. The Ezra's 1 Ezra chapter 7 verse 5 or Ezra chapter 6 verse 15. The building of the temple was completed in the sixth year of Darius, which would begin in 516 BC. That's where I got it from. Ezra 6:15. So I didn't just make it up, after all. I didn't think I did, but it's not my style. You got to go to Wickstrom for that shit. Ezra 6:15, and this house was finished on the third day in the month of Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. So it was started in the second year, so that's second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. That's 5 years. It's probably more like four, or closer to four. Especially since it's only like the third month of the 6 years. So, but that's, I gave it 5 years, but that's okay. It's still 516 BC. Is there anything else we should discuss here from Haggai? or I'll see y'all next week and we'll start Zechariah, which will be a lot longer and a lot more involved.
Well, I don't have anything else, and I'm looking forward to Zechariah because he's one of my favorite prophets. He's a CI prophet. They're all CI prophets.
Yes, sir. Well, Noble, if you have nothing to say, or Ram or anybody, we could call this a night. We lost Gerald. I guess he got tired. No, he's here. Gerald, damn it.